second case for oral argument this morning is on the matter of the estate of Cheryl D. Hoffman, deceased. For the appellant, we have Michael J. Schaefer, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And then for the appellee, Mr. Drew C. Johnson, an attorney from Ashdean. Mr. Schaefer, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mike Schaefer, and I represent Jack Eric, the personal representative of the estate of Cheryl Hoffman, his deceased daughter. There are two consolidated appeals. The first appeal raises the issue of whether straw transactions intended to destroy the right of survivorship in real or in personal property run afoul of or violate the restraining order in a divorce settlement. The second appeal raises the issue whether during the pendency of the first appeal, the trial court has jurisdiction to enter an order whose effect is essentially to force abandonment or dismissal of the first appeal.
Cheryl, is that moot once we're here? Because it hasn't been abandoned.
No, I never thought about it. I assume the court can address both issues or can decide that it's moot. We're going to go to the merits and we effectively got here anyway. But it has implications because the order essentially appointed two co-personal representatives, so it's going to have an effect on the subsequent disposition of the case if it is remanded for some reason. So I think the court probably needs to address that part of that.
But I mean, if the conduct of the court when you did that has not thrown you out of this court to argue your case, is what I'm saying.
Right, and I understand your point, but still the question goes to whether or not the court had jurisdiction to enter the orders or authority to enter the orders, and if he didn't, because of the appeal, they still may be void and should be voided or nullified.
And in that instance, you're telling us that the court did not find that your client should have been discharged under the statute.
Well,
yeah, there's nothing showing that he should not be the personal representative. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. He found no cause to discharge my client as personal representative, but effectively appointed two co-personal representatives that could overrule him. So effectively, he's a personal representative.
Under what authority?
I don't know. There's no citation to any statute or case law that I found that you can appoint co-personal representatives to override the personal representative when there's no cause for removal.
You look to me like he's just trying to settle this deal.
And I think there was certainly that in his mind to force a settlement, and we thought we had it settled, and then it blew up, and so we're here.
What's to prevent him from doing that on the second issue once the case goes back, to the circuit court judge?
Prevent him from reappointing?
Let's say it's determined to be void. What's to prevent him from doing it once we go back?
Well, I think you could issue some instructions with your opinion that would maybe limit what authority he has, because I don't think there's any statutory authority to dismiss a personal representative without cause.
Well, he wasn't dismissing him, though. He was just adding to in order to nullify him.
Right. So effectively, he's been dismissed because he has no power. He can't do anything. So he's there in name only. I mean, he doesn't have any right to do anything.
Well, you know, I always look at some people say, you always go to the red book. And, you know, I've hardly ever looked at one. But, you know, you look at it, what does the statute provide for? Does the statute provide for an appointing of a co-personal representative?
There's nothing in the statute that authorizes the appointment. There's references in statutes where there are co-personal representatives. Now, I assume there are wills that are probated where there's more than one personal representative nominated, and the courts, I assume, in those cases can appoint.
Just like you said, co-executive or administrator.
Right.
But so this is where did anyone make a motion for this?
Actually, the motion that was made was to remove my client and appoint Bruce Hoffman as personal representative. That was a motion that was made, and also to prevent my client from continuing with the appeal, to restrain him from appeal. That was a motion that was made. And the court basically says, well, I don't think I can enter an order that effectively prevents somebody from appealing my order. But he did it indirectly by appointing the co-personal representatives that essentially attempted to do the same thing.
So on issue two, in the long run, if the case goes back down and those two personal representatives are knocked out, the circuit court judge couldn't, without statutory grounds, terminate your client or appoint two new ones to nullify them without statutory grounds.
Right, without.
So it's a new ball game, and of course you could appeal that once again.
I assume that's true.
But you're saying, as I understand, that he had no authority to do it. Period.
Right.
Well, so it should be voided.
Well, and he had no jurisdiction.
And the client you represent was not found to be the person who was subject to removal, and he should be allowed to continue how the will appointed.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Now,
let me ask you one thing. And this obviously does not relate to the issue that's raised. The way supplemental authority that was brought seems to be that when this case goes back, the personal representative, if it stays as one person, is going to have to abide by the wishes of the heirs.
The supplemental authority that was cited is the statute 3912, which says, subject to the right of creditors and taxing authorities, competent successors may agree among themselves to alter the interests, shares, or amount to which they are entitled under the will of the decedent or under the laws of intestacy in any way that they provide in a written contract executed by all. And we don't have that now.
That's what's probably going to happen.
Well, the question really is, you know, two of these kids are minors. They're not competent to enter into a contract. The problem is Bruce Hoffman, their father, has been appointed guardian and conservator for those two children to act on their behalf. His interests are adverse to theirs. He was appointed by the same judge that decided this case. So it's never been clear to me, and we've never really got a handle on the property, to know whether or not these children have ever been informed or know the extent of the potential property that they have to recover. We requested numerous times from Mr. Johnson to give us an accounting because he made a claim for an augmented estate, which a surviving spouse who's written out of a will has a right to do. And so essentially what he has never given us this information other than that we got the financial statements, which just show generally what's there. But we specifically asked what property did they hold at the time of her death that was in joint tenancy, what was his separate property, so we know, so that the children could be informed at some point. Listen, we filed an inheritance tax report because we could determine on the real estate that the potential value of their interest in that was around $100,000, and that included the mortgages that were assigned to it. But we've never gotten a handle on the personal property because we've never been given any documentation or access to that to determine. But the children, to be competent, and they refer to the Vassgard case, this authority for this also, and I reread that, and it actually stands, it supports our position. There's dicta in there that says what they say, but the language in the opinion says that the agreement has to be fairly made. And I know this court has looked at cases and acknowledged family agreements that can dispose of property in the estate, but I'm not aware of a family agreement where everything is sort of just, all of it's gotten rid of. The beneficiaries lose everything to a surviving spouse, get nothing in return but the hope that someday down the road that there might be something there that he will leave to them, not knowing whether or not he might get mad at them or write them out of the will or get remarried or any of those circumstances. So in the first place, I don't know how there could be consideration for an agreement like that.
I don't want you to speak to this time. If you think, or to you tell me, isn't this something an authority aside issue? It doesn't relate to the issues.
It doesn't relate to the issues. It was never raised in the trial court. It was never, and I don't think it could ever rise. I don't think an agreement of this kind could ever be enforceable because in this court's own opinion, in the estate of Nieswender, the court said that these agreements are subject to rules of contract formation. And the proponent has the burden to prove the contract by evidence so clear and satisfactory that no doubt remains. How could you ever have consideration in a contract where they give up everything in exchange for an expectancy? I don't think it could be enforced. I've not seen a case where it ever happened. The statute says that they can alter their interests or shares, and most of the cases involve situations where parties elects not to take under the will, but to take by intestate succession, which was the case in the Dasgard case, because it maybe equalized the distributions among the children more equitably, but they still all recover. Now,
how about the termination of the joint tenancy? That seems to be the real critical.
That's exactly right. And the Cheryl Hoffman filed for divorce in October of 99, was diagnosed with cancer in November, changed her will November 20th of 99 to eliminate her husband as a beneficiary, leaving everything to her four children. In May, her attorney requested to have an expedited trial because of her condition, which her husband refused. In June, she goes into the hospital, and ultimately, her attorney prevails on Judge Erickson. That was a hand counting case in the Third Circuit. They have a trial, a telephone conference trial, on June 13, 2000 at 1 p.m. And she died that morning. But the day before she entered into these transactions to quit claim the real property and the bills of sale to her father, the intent was to sever the right of survivorship. The purpose of the restraining order in a divorce case is essentially to prevent property from being removed from the jurisdiction of the court or dissipated so that it's not available to be distributed in the divorce proceeding.
You're saying here the only change there was from joint tenancy with right of survivorship to tenancy in common.
Exactly.
It's still the same property, still the same value, and all it does is cut it in half.
It destroys the right of survivorship. It's the only thing it does. They both have undivided half interests in the same property.
Does the circuit court for probate administration have jurisdiction of this tenants in common property, which is now really already passed to the four children if it's affected, subject only to, I mean, it's really passed subject to as of the date of death, that's it.
It should pass through the will as of the date of death.
The real property vests upon the death, but it's administered through the
Right.
But is it subject to the administration of the circuit court if it's passed to the children?
Well, it's probably subject to a claim for an augmented estate or for a share if you haven't gotten to of the surviving husband. But I think you might be right, but I don't know that he can go back and undo that. But the point is,
so hasn't she in effect, you know, whether or not she just prevented dissipation by him in the future, or whether she's dissipated it from the court's jurisdiction, it appears that there's more to it than originally stated. She has done more than just terminate. She's done more than change the ownership, but by her death, she has kind of taken it out of the circuit court's administration.
You mean in the divorce proceeding?
Yeah.
Well, I think the divorce proceedings terminate upon death, so that happens all at the same time. Okay. Some of the cases have said, in fact, that if the divorce proceeding terminates, the restraining order terminates, poof, the property goes to her surviving the people that she wanted to get it, and there's nothing to prevent.
Right. But in the future, it seems like it would have maybe more effect on this case, our holding on issue one. Will have more effect on this case because the wife immediately dies than it would in the average case, because if in fact the both the wife and the husband are still living, although they're going through a divorce, the court would of course have jurisdiction over that property, even though she owned it as a tenant in common rather than a joint tenant.
That's exactly right. In fact, one of the cases that was cited by Mr. Johnson, a Michigan case, it's the Irvin versus Irvin case. That's what happened, and the trial court said this wife, the surviving spouse, can't come out better because she hung around until her husband died, and then she gets everything. So we're not going to enforce that restraining order and let it go to the deceased husband's children, as he indicated by severing that expectancy.
It isn't just the savings plan. situation is different. There's no longer just an expectancy. There has been a change in property interests. Because it's done, coupled with the change in ownership.
But every case that I've read says that destroying the right of survivorship does not either constitute a transfer of property for purposes of that restraining order, and that the expectancy, the right of survivorship, isn't a property interest, or as our statute says, marital asset. Because nobody has, because a mere expectancy can't be transferred, it's not a thing, it's not, you know, that's exactly what it is.
But what I'm asking is, with this combination of the strong and transaction, the death sort of so close together, isn't it affecting what happened?
I don't think so, because every one of these cases, every case we found supports our position. We found no other case, and some of these people have died within a month or various time periods from when this right was destroyed. I don't think the timing of when she made the transfer and when she died makes a difference.
You got to look at what happened at the time. You don't look what happens in the future. And what happened at the exact time is that the property is still there.
Right.
It hasn't changed the property, it's just changed how it's held. And if she doesn't pass away, that property is still there for the divorce court to handle. Isn't that the critical thing here?
That's exactly right.
Has the divorce been actually handled in the very
question? Yes. Yes.
Well, now what about the proceeding to determine whether or not she violated the order? That's what's happening, isn't that what's before us, or what is it?
What's before you is whether she violated the order, but it's being decided in the probate case as opposed to going back before the divorce court. We have the divorce court rule on whether it was.
It's the same judge.
Different judge. Different circuits. The divorce was in Hahn County, the Third Circuit.
Okay.
The probate's in Spink County, the Fifth Circuit.
So what's the question of whether she violated the order?
Exactly right.
And if you say she violated the order, then the property goes back to the way it was before she
did. That's right. But here, what Judge Loverin focused on is just the transfer. He said, once she transferred the property to her dad, that's all I looked at. The transfer is complete. That's in violation of the restraining order. I don't care what happened afterwards.
And that's clearly what the statute says. The transfer is
Well, the cases that we've found said that a straw man transaction was transferred to the straw man and then back to the person doesn't constitute a transfer. I think the Lonergan case says it's a technical transfer, but it shouldn't be set aside because all you're doing is destroying it. You're not destroying a property interest, you're just destroying an expectancy.
Well, it doesn't transfer anything to a party that's not involved in the litigation where you're supposed to not be dissipating or doing anything.
Right. What the court says, you have to look at the purpose of the divorce order. And the purpose is to prevent dissipation or secretion of assets outside of the jurisdiction of the court. So when you look at the entire transaction, the property's still there. It's just held in a different form. It's not violated the purpose or intent of the divorce restraining order. Many of the courts interpret those cases exactly under the same analysis. The cases all say, Your Honor, that it's not, the purpose of that order isn't to maintain the status quo, it's to prevent dissipation of property. And if you're going to maintain the status quo, then theoretically you could prevent a party, and the same reasoning would apply, from changing their will after the divorce starts. You can't change your will because you might change somebody's expectancies in property that was included in the original will.
It looks like this, did this, so that there'd be something to go through her will to where she wanted it to go.
She wanted it to go to her children, so that they would have something, and that's exactly right.
But do you conclude that the probate court judge in the future is just attacking the family, that he can make an order relating to the augmentation of the estate for the benefit of the husband, and that's superior to the rights of the children that they got from the mother?
It only is, Judge, if, and I see my time is up, but it only is if the augmented estate...
You get to answer whether you concede or not.
And I don't know, the property situation is probably such that it might make no difference, because Mr. Hoffman has his own separate property, real estate and other property, that we think that the augmented estate might not get into this property that's been willed to the children. But if it does, it does.
Okay, and so then you do concede that the probate court judge in the future will have the right to declare, to augment the estate if it's necessary.
Yes.
Over the rights of the children who have received that.
And that's exactly the point. That's the remedy for surviving spouses written out of the will. Not to go behind the scenes and try and do it this other way and create a separate exception. The augmented estate is a statutory remedy for surviving spouses written out.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Johnson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court and counsel. SDCL 25-433.1 specifically reads, paraphrase, upon the filing of the son's complaint for divorce, a temporary restraining order shall be in effect against both parties until the final decree is entered, complaint dismissed, until further order of the court.
All right, say the property is worth $50,000. Who's transferred 5 minutes later, she's still in possession of $50,000 of the property in the future.
No. I pointed out a number of reasons I believe that the transfer that we're involved with here did in fact subject his interest in this land to further claims of other creditors and a homestead exemption. And this land was coming back through that second deed from the father of the decedent, the grandfather of the children in these days. The wife never signed off on it. She's a living heir to his estate and has a homestead right now because one of the quarters was a very expensive homestead that the parties had. Now the grandmother has an interest in that claim. And if you condone this kind of conduct, those are the kind of problems you're going to have in the future. You've got this statute that says you can do it. It's a transfer. There's no question about it. Judge Lover said it was a transfer. The law says it's a transfer. The law says you can't do it. Why condone contemptuous behavior of Cheryl Hoffman in this case? And she knew for 6 months that she was terminated. And her attorney did nothing to go to court like the statutes allows you to do and get that permission.
You can give your position to the same, it would be the same effect whether you made a transfer of the joint tenancy to herself as a joint tenant and eliminated the straw man claim. Is that in violation of all four, you saying?
I think that still would be a violation. And I say that because in this particular case, her intent was strictly to benefit her estate, who had the kids, who are also my client's kids.
If there were judgments on standing against her father and against herself, would those judgments attach to the land, to the property, while it's the tenants in common with the father before it comes back to her, and we put a judgment attached to that as against her?
As far as going through the straw man and then coming back,
right.
I think the judgments clearly do attach as soon as the property is put in his name, which it was in this case.
But in this case, there were no judgments?
I'm not even aware of that. We've done no title search of his property. Appeals were filed for the other day. But again, the self-conveyance, as many of these other cases called for self-conveyances, where a deed is given from the joint tenant's wife to herself again as a bank account. There are 8 cases, I believe, in the appellant's brief. Only one of those cases, out of the 8, deals with a straw man transaction that's applicable to this case, where the father or husband gave a deed to a third person, and then that came back to him from that third person, assuming it is. That court.
If we assume that these are transaction, would he actually be a third? If you say it would be invalid either way.
I would say it'd be invalid either way.
Which word would it be, the beginning words in that violation? Says transferring, encumbering, concealing, or in any way dissipating the authority. Now, which one of those did he complain of?
In this particular case, the transfer was from herself as a joint tenant to herself as an individual, which
it
again...
But it says in the statute, that we have a statute, it's a client statute, it says from one living person to another. He didn't transfer it to another, he transferred it to herself.
Your Honor, the question is not the code, and that's the issue that's never been decided by this court, is whether or not you can have a self-conveyance. California's got a special statute that talks about a self-conveyance that's been legislated into their law. We don't have that inside the code. You have a transfer from one person to another, and I think that's why the attorney in this case was Cheryl Hoffman, who is the divorce attorney, ignored the statute here, says you can't do it, but went to the straw man anyway because he didn't know if it was going to be acceptable in South Dakota to do it with a self-conveyance. So to be sure, he used the Schenemke case that it was done in, where she divided up her joint tenancy to a tenant, to a third party altogether in that case, but divided up that joint tenancy, and it was approved by this court. But it wasn't approved as a self-conveyance until you have a law in South Dakota that says you can do that. He took this other way. And until we have a law in South Dakota that says you can do it here, I don't think that's applicable still.
Well, the case you referred to said that you can break up a joint tenant.
The Schenemke case, that's correct.
No, there's no doubt about that, and that's precedent. That hasn't been changed in this state, has it?
It has because of the virtue of this statute right here, 25.433.1, that says you can't make that transfer in a divorce case.
Oh, within the board. It doesn't change the law that it can be done. You're just saying that once that temporary restraining order is in, that changes the holding of that case.
In a divorce case with marital property, no question.
But the question is how did she dissipate any asset of it? Because after it's done, and I'm having a problem, it's still the same property. And the only difference is now it's held undivided one half in one name. And undivided one half and another. There isn't anything in that restraint order that says it always has to remain a joint tenancy, is it?
That's true, but the question is, why do we have to come to this court to see if this is permissible? Why not go back to the trial court?
Because we're here, we always welcome you to that court.
Right. But. To the trial court, because our astute legislature said, those possibilities exist under this statute, why not use it? Go to the trial court and ask to do that. Divide up this property from joint tenancy, tenancy, and common. You can do that. It doesn't say you can't do it. The Lordan case from Arizona in 85, which is the only case that's similar to this case out of the 8th that they cite, said that the Arizona Supreme Court did not like the idea that the restraining order here would prevent an estate planning tool like dividing up Johnny Hill property, joint tenancy, tenancy, common. But this statute doesn't do that. The statute says you can ask for permission from the court to do it. Why not get the involvement of the court to see if, in fact, that's the best for the parties in the divorce action?
Were you involved in the divorce action?
Yes, I was.
So it's apparently been an ongoing battle over getting it resolved. And
contrary to the assertions of Mr. Schaefer, we did not hold up anything in this case. We did diligent work in trying to get this case to the court for a trial. We did not see any interrogatories or requests for productions from the plaintiff's attorney, Cheryl's attorney, until May. And when they filed those, they immediately asked for a trial date to be set within a week or two. We hadn't even responded to their interrogatories, and the judge said, no, I'm not going to give you that trial date. We set one for July, I believe it was, about the middle of July. The day of June 12th, I got a fax copy of a notice sent to me for a trial starting that morning at 9 o'clock. And it was about 10:30 when I got the fax message. Actually, with an error in the trial date, it was supposed to be the next morning at 9 o'clock. Well, we're going to go to trial on a half a day notice in this divorce case, and I was not prepared for it. As God would have it, if I can use that phrase, Cheryl died at 9 o'clock that morning. But when she went to her attorney and said, I want to file this deed to transfer my property to my dad, and he can give it back to me, she did it knowing this restraining order was still in place, and her attorney allowed her to do it. He had 6 months to do that. He knew she was terminal. She had about 6 months to go. Why didn't they do it?
Did you buy into this question about whether the deeds that she signed, if they're effective automatically, now place the best children with the property? Or do you agree that if we say that this transaction is void, the deeds
you would be affirming the trial court's order, which has already vacated those transfers. And that's a matter of public record, and as far as the registry of deeds is concerned, those transfers never occurred. That's never been changed. So yes, that's where this court would stand if you affirm this the trial court's holding and finding that the transfers were illegal. The transfers have been already set aside, and we are being held up in our farm operation for 2 years now, not knowing for sure what's going on with this property, and that's raising some kind of havoc on this operation. If I may get into the appointment of the personal representatives for a minute, the question was raised earlier if this was a moot point. I don't believe
you could
it
be held up on the farm operations if the divorce was still going. It isn't. I mean, people have a right to proceed in court to which they feel their rights are, don't they?
Absolutely.
Was that a material issue as far as being held up that the trial court relied on? No, that has got nothing to do with this case right now.
My point being is that the conduct of the deceased in this case has done that to us in violation of the court order, and I think that's why we have to give some sanctity to our trial court order. How are we as practitioners supposed to know?
You mean a half of this property sits out there where no one can touch it?
No, it's being farmed, but we can't use it as collateral. We don't know who owns it. We absolutely can't borrow on it. You know of a farm operation today that doesn't go to a bank and borrow money? We can't do it. In fact, I think that this case may change the funding mechanisms for many of those farm operations if this kind of transaction will be approved by this court. All of these other cases that they cite as support, and again, only one really applies, but none of them consider that question. Why don't they go to the trial court to get permission to do these deeds like this? So we have some safeguard in how the property is handed down through the divorce or maybe eventually to a probate. And Cheryl Hoffman did the deed. She knew that within days, if not hours, she was going to die.
In all of the cases, so can you distinguish between the transfer and not the
that's right.
And that's the legal proposition. It's really involved.
That's true. But again, Cheryl Hoffman in this case knew that her death was imminent and that she was going to violate this court order as soon as she died because she effectively took this property away from Bruce Hoffman, at least half of it, and put it in her own name to go by her will. And that does something the divorce court, I don't think, would have ever done in this case, and that is to divide up a farm operation. The Grody case that I point out called the farm operation a ship. You always try to keep the ship afloat. The husband usually gets the farm, the wife gets compensated monetarily. That's the way it's always done in any divorce I've ever handled for a farm. And that's what should have been done here. But because of her contentious attitude towards the court's order, that was not allowed to go on. If she had asked Judge Erickson permission
well,
to do
there
that,
there would have never been anything where she got anything of payment because she passed away.
That's correct.
Continue your answer, though. You say if she'd asked Judge Erickson, then what?
If she had asked Judge Erickson to divide up this property, Judge Erickson, knowing how what her state of health was and what it would do to the farm, and that is to divide it in half, have something that he as a divorce judge would not have done in the divorce case itself, why would he condone it upon her death? I don't think he would have done it. But if you take that order, when they had asked for it, and it was, no, you can't do it, and they would have done it anyway, would we still be out here today? I can't believe we would authorize or condone that kind of conduct. And that's exactly what we're doing here. We have to prepare our cases according to law as we see it, it's written. We can't come up here and ask this court to give us a bunch of exceptions or rewrite the law. It says no transfer.
You say that it would have been up to them to appeal Judge Erickson's denial of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they could have done it on an expedited basis because of her terminal condition. I would think you would have accommodated in that regard. But we didn't do that, and so we're here today with this same argument that could have been avoided. Don't let us practicing attorneys find out piece by piece, case by case, what this statute says, because that's what we will do to you. We really will. We will have all kinds of schemes and mechanisms to somehow skirt the law as we see it until the legislature comes back and says, we'll rewrite it. Don't. Please don't rewrite it. The personal representatives in this particular
case. You know, when you transfer something, it seems like you're trying to get it out of the jurisdiction that you're under. And this did not get it out of any jurisdiction, this act by the deceased, really.
It did.
Now let me say this. If she did it and didn't pass away, it would still be in that divorce proceeding, wouldn't it?
It would be subject to Mrs. Urich's homestead exemption. It could have been subject to any judgments, and I don't know if there are any.
I'm saying it would still have been an asset that would have been in consideration in the divorce.
Perhaps with some encumbrances, and the statute also covers that.
But it'd be there. She didn't move out of the county.
Would you agree with that? The personal property in 2 years since we've been involved in this has changed. I mean, this is farm machinery gets traded, it's sold or whatever. The livestock is traded.
Is all that through court order?
Pardon me?
That's all done through court order approval in the divorce, was it?
No, I mean, since the death. The death was in June of 2000. We're in August of this year, so this property and the personal property and this farm has got to change hands, and there was no order in the trial court stopping it from being changed. And that's another part of this problem in this case, was there was no stay order in the trial court to stop me from going to court and asking the judge to do something to acknowledge the heirs in this case and what they wanted done or not done. The judge says they're entitled to be heard. Our statutes say they're entitled to be heard. That one statute, 912, clearly says they have a right to change things.
They're represented by an attorney?
Yes, Scott Cook represented them at the hearing in February of 2002. And he had talked to them. They all came in except one who was still in school. And they all testified, Judge, we know what we're doing. We don't want this property coming back to the estate. We don't want to handle it. We trust our dad. We like our dad. Let him keep the farm afloat. And the judge says they're entitled to be heard. And that statute, 912, has that same broad connotation to it. The heirs have to be heard. Mr. Schaefer announces his presence today on behalf of Jack Urich. That's wrong. He's here for the estate. Jack Urich represents the estate. He doesn't represent himself as the grandfather of his kids or as the father of the deceased. He represents the estate, and the estate has heirs to it. And the four heirs of this estate all say, we don't want this property coming back. Dismiss the appeal. They told them before they filed the first appeal on November 1st of 2001. They told them again in February of this year, dismiss the appeal, leave us noted. The judge said there's a way to remedy this. It was his idea, not mine. I'll appoint two other personal representatives. I think there's authority for that. In 29A3607, and I'm going to paraphrase again, on petition of any person who appears to have an interest in the estate, and I break there to say, no doubt the heirs here have an interest in this estate, leaving out some portions there, it says the court may make any other order to secure proper performance by the personal representative if it appears to the court that the personal representative otherwise may take some action which would jeopardize unreasonably the interest of the petitioner or of some other interested person. End quote. That's their right as heirs to be heard in what they want done in this case. They don't want this real property brought back.
Well,
they don't.
We have a more fundamental issue here, and that is jurisdiction. Aside from authority to go to the state jurisdiction, my question is, other than the state rule that you concerned with.
Yes, I use the case of Dardanelle Financial Corporation versus, I forget the last name, Home Federal, I believe. It was a foreclosure action. The foreclosure took place. There was an appeal. And the running of the redemption time, which continued to run. And I'm so.
Which is a wholly different thing than taking an appeal. I mean, that's what this that goes back to the state statute. You get to enforce the judgment, you have to wait to get it.
As I read that case, I thought the redemption time, if there was a stay because of the automatic appeal, would have been stayed, the redemption time would have also been stayed because of the appeal, but that wasn't the case. I think the enforcement, the stay order from the trial court would have stayed anything that I could have done down there, because there was none. Petitioning the court to acknowledge the position of the heirs in this case, I think is appropriate under that statute I just read, and we can be brought back in and look at the first representative. If he's doing what is best for the estate, and I contend that what he is doing is not best for the estate being four people, and the four people don't want it, and he isn't listening. So, with my little time left, I would ask that this trial court gave due consideration to the statute, due consideration to the fact he made the proper legal conclusion that the transfer has to be set aside and the facts are ordered. And we ask that you affirm that decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Schaefer, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Your Honor, the Dardanelle case involved the stay statute. The court said because they didn't post a supersedious bond to stay enforcement of the order, that was the reason why. That's not an issue. This order of Judge Lovren vacating the transfers was enforced. In fact, Mr. Johnson went out and filed them with the clerk's support 10 days after the orders were entered. If what he's saying is true, then you could cut off somebody's right of appeal anytime by having the trial court do something to interfere with it. And I sat in that rotunda when the most recent member of this court was invested, and Judge Gilbertson, the Chief Justice, pointed out that one of the important rights that we have in South Dakota is the right of appeal. We don't have an intermediate court of appeal. We don't have discretionary appeals. We have appeal as a matter of right. This judgment that was entered that we appealed from was a final judgment. If we're going to say that a trial court can enter orders effectively nullifying the right of appeal, which is what's been going on here, then we've destroyed the right of appeal, which is a right that we all have in this state. With respect to self-conveyances, I think that's exactly the point. I think Cheryl Hoffman could have done the same exact thing through a self-conveyance. In fact, the cases that looked at those say, many of them where there was a straw transaction, say that she could have done or he could have done the same thing through a self-conveyance. It wouldn't have been in violation, and we're elevating form over substance if we look at that transfer back and forth to violate the restraining order of the divorce summons. Every single case in the United States that we've found supports our position. There is no case that supports their position in this case. Mr. Johnson gets up here and asks the court to follow the law. Well, I agree. We should look at the law of these other jurisdictions, which have similar statutes to what South Dakota has, similar rights and similar restraining orders. In fact, many of them are identical. And I submit that this is not in violation of that restraining order.
How do you respond to his point that you really did change the property by subjecting it to judgments, homestead interests, et cetera, by using the term?
I don't agree. Well, first of all, there's no evidence that it was. There were no judgments against Jack Urich.
That's part of the record.
It's not part of the record, but I mean, he's my uncle. I know if there aren't any. Well, I mean, maybe we have to go back and do it.
Is that part of the record? We got to look through the family tree.
No, please respond.
The right. I mean, I don't think that a person who takes has temporary possession of property that is not his homestead implicates the wife's homestead. And I looked at the Grigsby case. I mean, Mr. Johnson has raised that issue about this statute in South Dakota and that we couldn't do this because there's... And the Grigsby case basically California had the same, virtually the same statute that says that didn't prevent this type of transaction. And that was a straw transaction where it went from Mrs. Grigsby to somebody else.
So let me ask you this about the judge. Why do we get certified copies of judgments and trot them down and have them file the records? Because of the fact that if someone comes into something later on, that judgment's there can attach. I mean, it does. The thing about it is it doesn't have to be in someone's hand a year. All it has to do is show up in the chain of title, isn't it? And that judgment can trigger in and attach on an asset, right?
I think it has to attach after, the property, the person that the judgment's against has to have ownership of the
property. Let me tell you, of course, this shows my age, and you probably never had to go through this menial task. But reviewing abstracts, it shows a chain of title. And you look at the chain of title, and the name of your relative would show up in the chain. Otherwise, the abstractor isn't doing their job. And so if that shows up, and let's say over here, there's a judgment for $10,000, and you say there is, let's just say there is. That's going to show up as a cloud on that interest that's later shown as transferred. Isn't that a potential problem?
Well, maybe it is, but it's never been addressed, quite frankly, by any of these courts as a reason for not
allowing
these. It's never been...
But it's right inherent in the issue of whether or not it's a dissipation, isn't it? It could be an unintentional dissipation. As a matter of fact, when it comes back to her alone, and if there's a judgment against her, that would be an unintentional dissipation. So even though it's not been addressed, clearly it's a problem of permitting things to happen to the property that were taken outside the jurisdiction of the trial court.
I guess I've never seen any...
Well, it could... The only thing I'd say, it could encumber that you wouldn't know.
But
there's a potential...
We don't have any evidence in this case that happened.
Okay.
Well, that's true. We have precedential value to this decision, and we have to say the next time out that there is no judgment that attaches. In other words, Mr. Gates, Chairman Johnson, has, of course, said, okay, so we're going to do it now, too. This isn't decided in isolation.
But when a lien, the judgment would be attached to an expense as opposed to a trip on property.
I don't think so.
But it wouldn't be an expectancy, would it, if it comes back to her as a tenant in common?
She would hold the property
as
a tenant in common.
That's not an expectancy.
No, she would have an ownership interest.
Right.
Yeah.
And the judgment was attached there. And the property going to him, the expectancy doesn't relate to your uncle. The property is deeded to your uncle. If there's a judgment on the property against him at that time, that will show up, and then you've got legal complications later on.
I think that's probably the right thing.
Okay.
You could.
Right.
Okay. So isn't it really dangerous to permit the lawyers in the state of South Dakota to do this? In the end, the estate's going to all be eaten up over legal battles. Going back and forth to the Supreme Court or the Circuit Court.
I think the policy reasons for not allowing this are even greater. You're going to say if your spouse is ill during the divorce, just hang on, drag the thing out, and you'll eventually get everything anyway. Or, I look at it this way. This so-called agreement where we want the heirs to have their any time you have minor children or children involved and one spouse dies, even if they're not on bad terms at the time of death, the dad could say or mom could say, I think I should have everything. You guys agree to that?
How do you respond to Mr. Johnson's book? He had a remedy and chose not to use it for 6 months. He could have gone in petition and divorced him.
We realize it's a different, that's an attorney different than you. But,
right.
Right.
But he could have got a trial on 10 days notice.
Everyone, I don't know whether he could have got a trial on 10 days notice. Every one of these cases stands for the proposition, everybody in all of these cases either did a self-conveyance or a straw man transaction, and the courts never said, and they have similar language, you can't do it without the consent of the other party or without an order of the court. The purpose is what you have to look at. The purpose is to prevent dissipation or disposing of the marital assets. Our statute says marital assets, other statutes say property. I don't think a right of survivorship is a marital asset, period. And that's basically what we're dealing with here. And all of the cases have said that you can't elevate form over substance to effectively quash this, because the purpose of the restraining order in the divorce court isn't to determine the person's probate intent or their intent to dispose of their assets on death, is to keep the stuff there so the divorce court has jurisdiction over it. So for all, I mean, I think that there's policy reasons that fly the other way that would create more problems. In fact, there'd be a very good argument a person could never change their will after a divorce is instituted, because a will writing out the husband essentially deprives him of some expectancy, or may deprive him of some expectancy.
But even the order that says there's no transfer says subject to further order of the court. So the court can change it upon good cause in a 10-day deal or on shortened notice if the circumstances were exigent. So it's all subject to the order of the court. So why not solve the problem on the circuit court level and the probate court level before it ever gets out of that county?
Well, I wasn't representing her, and I know that she died, and obviously she was on her deathbed when she did this. So
she
didn't
have 6 months before that, didn't she, to bring it on for a hearing, to bring it on to the trial court, to ask to get his permission to do it?
As did everybody in all these other cases that we talked about. In Shimke, this Supreme Court decision says a spouse can dispose of the joint tenancy property without the knowledge or consent of her husband.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Your time is up. Court will be in recess. Stand adjourned.